You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
This is Live from the Table, the official podcast of The Comedy Cellar. We're here at Sirius XM Raw Dog 99. This is Dan Natterman, filling in for Noam because he's late, he's stuck in traffic. And we're broadcasting today from the Sirius XM studios in beautiful Midtown Manhattan because Adam Carolla's coming in a bit. And we needed to be here to interview Adam Carolla. So we're at Sirius. I'm here with Perry Al Ashenbrand.
Hi.
And special guest, outside Steve Fabricant, who has been... Hello, Stephen.
How you doing, Dan?
Stephen has been on our show before.
I have.
And he wanted to come because he wanted to meet Adam, I think.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Adam's. I listen to his radio show, his podcast, I mean. And I'm a big fan of his politics and his philosophies and where he came from and who he is now.
Well, do you have any questions you're dying to ask him?
Well, I'm going to have to chew on that for a minute.
Well, yeah, think about it.
I'll think about it.
By the way, Steve, I heard you on Slate's, Slate.com. They're doing a whole series on the Comedy Cellar,
a series
of interviews.
I'm so annoyed about it. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, they interviewed me a few weeks ago, and I think it just came out.
I've listened to all the interviews. They interviewed you, they've interviewed Esty, they've interviewed Noam, they've interviewed Aaron Nystrup, the waiter, and Will Silvins. But anyway, I enjoyed your interview.
I told the story about you, I believe.
You did tell the story about me.
That's why he enjoyed it.
No, that's actually not why I enjoyed it, but you can retell the story if you want, for us, for our listeners.
It was that time Robert De Niro did that movie, The Comedian.
By the way, for those who haven't heard Steve on the show before, he is the guy that stands outside the Comedy Cellar that basically checks everybody in before they sit down.
Basically.
Anyway, so tell the De Niro story, if you will.
So they filmed The Comedian. They asked me to be play outside
the movie The Comedian.
The movie The Comedian. And I had a scene with him where I shake his hand and welcome him into the Comedy Cellar, or I guess it was a generic comedy club within the movie. And I turned to you and I asked you if you can get a picture of me and Robert De Niro. Remember that?
Yes, I remember. Yeah. And not only do I remember, but I remember I heard you tell this story on Slate too. So
I'm like, Dan, this is gonna, it's amazing. And if you could just, you're like, yeah, sure. So I shot the scene with Robert De Niro. They closed the street down and lights, camera, action. And it was very exciting. It was a very surreal experience for me to be with my idol, Robert De Niro. Anybody that knows me knows that I quote that movie probably a million times a day. And for about 2 hours, they did about a dozen takes. And after the scene was over, I ran over to you. I'm like, Dan, did you get the picture? And you're like, oh, man, they told me to move aside and I didn't get a clear shot of the picture, so I couldn't get one off. I'm sorry. And I said, Dan, well, that's okay. I'll get another picture with him next time I'm in a scene with Robert De Niro.
Yeah, that's Steve's, I think, favorite story.
Yeah, that was a long setup, but...
the truth is the camera crew did tell me to beat it now. Now, maybe a real friend would have...
A real friend would have gotten one off somehow.
You said something in the interview I wanted to... question you about. You had said that the younger comics, you see them working at the tables at the Comedy Cellar doing jokes a lot, and that they're more hungry than the older comics.
Oh boy, I knew this would bother somebody.
Well, I don't know if it bothered me. Because I think it might. There's truth to it.
I said the older, more complacent comics aren't as hungry because they're more experienced, they're more confident, and they know how to make a joke work without...
Well, those are two separate issues. They're not as hungry, and they're more confident.
I'm saying the older comedians may be more confident.
But you also said they're less hungry.
Probably, yeah.
And that makes sense.
But it depends on what...
Except for the fact that it's not necessarily the case. But a lot of times, I mean, I'll speak for myself. First of all, Colin Quinn is probably more productive than ever.
Oh, he writes like crazy.
He just did a one-man show.
Yeah.
And he's always doing new one-man shows. David Attell is probably as productive as ever. You run down to watch him all the time. I mean, he's still pumping out jokes constantly.
Right. And you're suffering. You're a great joke writer.
And I am more productive than ever. And the reason I'm more productive, I can't speak for these other cats, but the reason I'm more productive than ever is because panic is setting in. The older I get, in fact, the more I used to think, it'll be all right, and somebody will put me in a TV show or put me in a movie, or, you know, they'll recognize my abilities. And now as I realize, well, that's not coming, my only option is to just keep writing more jokes, and I see these young guys coming up, you know, and I
nipping
say
nipping at your heels.
They're nipping at my heels, and I say, well, geez, the only thing I can do now is to keep writing and to try to be funnier than everybody, at least make that attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So as age is approaching, the panic is setting in, I feel like I have to be more productive, because in this business, being young is an advantage. So when you're old, you don't have that advantage. You have to compensate with just being better.
Do you think that's true? I don't know that I've accomplished
that, but, well, do I think what is true?
That being old is a disadvantage?
Of course it's true. It's absolutely true.
In anything in life, probably.
I don't know. I mean,
in terms of how you're perceived by the end, if I was able to go back in time and be 30 years old with the same jokes that I have right now, the same ability I have right now, but I was 30, I would probably be a millionaire within 12 months at the outside. That would be my guess. Maybe I'd say 2 years. 2 years. 2 years. If I were 30 with this ability, because everybody would be like, holy shit, this guy's a genius. He's been doing it. What, for how long has he been doing it? He's so young. And
you always get mad at me when I say this, but I mean, I feel like I spend a not insignificant amount of time around you, and people come up to you all the time and they tell you that you're easily like one of the funniest comics.
Well, I don't think they come up to me all the time.
Well, when we're doing those
people are not industry people. Those are people. I'm telling you that Comedy Central or the networks, if they see a young guy with any ability at all, that young guy gets extra credit because he's young.
Can we digress to what bothered you about my statement about the younger guys?
It didn't bother me. I just think it's untrue, at least in certain cases, in terms of the hunger.
When's the last time you sat at a table and bounced ideas?
I don't work that way.
Okay.
Yeah, I just don't work. I don't bounce shit off. That's not how I work. I write jokes myself. I've tried that, and it just doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's David Attell doesn't bounce jokes off other comics
either. He sits in the hallway and he asks people if anybody touched upon a certain
idea. Yeah, David Attell does that. He'll ask if David Attell doesn't want to do jokes that have been done or topics that he once called me up. The only time he's ever called me, David Attell called me up about 15 years ago and said, "Dan, do you have a joke about fucking a goat?"
Yeah.
And I said,
he does that. He calls me and asks me.
And I said, no. And he goes, okay. And that was the only phone conversation I've ever had with him.
Yeah, that's Dave. He's original, and it's important to him to stay original.
But the point is when he's writing, he doesn't talk to other comedians.
He doesn't need to bounce ideas off of people.
That's not how he works, whether he needs it or not. That's just not how he works.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So I just want to address that. Steve, by the way, another thing I didn't know about you is you were a car salesman prior to, or in, but you've been at the Cellar since like 1995?
Yeah, on and off. I mean, it wasn't a straight run through, but most of the years I was there.
Of that time, you were selling cars.
Yeah, after 9/11, I moved out of New York for about a year and a half, 2 years.
What kind of cars?
Chevys.
Were you any good at it?
I sold a few.
Where'd you move to?
I was paying my rent in West Palm Beach.
I'm the worst. So I tried to sell real estate, but briefly after college, I went into, because I couldn't get a job anywhere else because my grades weren't very good, and coming out of Wharton, and
you went to Wharton.
I know, but my grades were bad because that was a very bad time for me, and I just kind of didn't do anything for 4 years.
Sure.
And I tried to sell real estate, but I once showed up at a showing without the key. You know, so I. And anyway, but so you've been at the Cellar since 1995, 1996. Have you ever, do you imagine yourself at the Comedy Cellar indefinitely, forever?
I'll probably die there. I don't know. I'm getting kind of burnt out now, actually, to be honest. It's just, like I said in the other interview, it's not a difficult job. It's not a, you don't have to be a genius to do it, but it's very stressful, you know, when you deal with that many people. 120 people a show, three shows a night, 30, 40 standby people a show. I mean, it's exasperating. By the end of the day, I'm exhausted emotionally.
Well, is there anything else you could imagine doing?
Not really, no. You know, I dabble in real estate, as you know.
I didn't know.
Yeah,
well, I don't think I knew.
Well, with Mark and...
Mark who?
Mark.
Oh, my ear. Okay, yeah. Okay. I knew you were friends with him. I didn't know you were actually involved in real estate. But.
Well, you know, a few rentals here and there have come up. I'm not a licensed broker or anything, but I, you know, help find customers.
Well, I will say, if you do leave, that would be...
devastating.
It would be hurtful to me, because I enjoy seeing you there.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. You know, I do think of you as a very dear, dear friend. And I have for a long time.
Well, we're friendly. We don't get together outside the Comedy Cellar.
Bar mitzvahs and funerals.
Yes, that's true. But we don't
get together.
We get together at big events where a lot of people are there. But you don't call me up and say, hey, Dan, what are you doing?
No, but we do see each other about 5 days a week.
Right, that's what I was going to say, but you're always, both of you are there so often.
We're work friends, but
yes.
We haven't broached
that next level of friendship where one of us might call the other up and say, hey, what are you doing?
We've had lunch together.
Because we're at the Comedy Cellar and you say, Dan, you want to get something to eat?
No, lunch, like we've met with Gary.
Have we?
I don't sure.
Know. Maybe so. Anyway, it's not critical. I'm just saying. I am outlining the level of our friendship for the listeners, so they get an idea of what goes on.
Our relationship isn't like you and Dove.
No, it's not Dove like me and Dove. But I wouldn't be against it.
Well, thank you.
But you're going to have to make the first.
Nor
move.
Nor I.
Because I don't make the first move. So you're going to have to. I know Russ Manee was very fond of you. Perhaps we can all do something together.
Are you afraid I might break up with you?
No, I'm just not aggressive like that. I'm not friendship aggressive.
I hear you. When you get older,
in a friendship, somebody's got to be the first person to say, "Hey, let's take this to another level."
Do you find it harder to make friends when the older you get? Because I do.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. You know, I mean, the kids they got a ton of friends, and I have, you know, fewer and fewer as time goes on.
I hear that.
By the way, in comedy news, I don't know if you have any thoughts. First of all, Amy Schumer was there last night, right?
Yeah.
She's back.
She's back.
She was at the Comedy Cellar.
She was. She did a spot on the first show.
Did she bring the baby by any chance?
No.
That's very impressive.
Gina Tell.
That she's out and about already.
I'll take your word. I don't know. Is it tough after you give birth to do shit?
I mean, yeah. You're like leaking blood into a diaper for weeks on end.
But that doesn't that should be good.
Please.
That could be good comedy.
Well, I'm not saying it's not good comedy. I'm just saying it's not that easy to like bounce around.
Okay, I didn't.
How
know
many kids do you have?
One.
Okay.
She posted on Instagram. She posted a picture of herself in front of the Comedy Cellar, you know, in front of the sign on stage. So, that once again, you know, great publicity for the club. you know, I'm. You know, just the juggernaut continues. And I'm not.
He can never get over it.
Well, it's kind of incredible. And I'm not bragging. I had nothing to do with it, and it's not my club. This is all to Gnome's benefit mainly, and indirectly it benefits us because the hotter the club is, the more people come, and the more shows we can do.
Do you wish that you were an owner?
Well, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess. I never thought crossed my mind, because why would I be an owner?
Would you give up your
comedy? Why the hell would I be an owner?
Would you give up your comedy career to own the cellar?
To own the entire cellar?
Half the cellar.
Maybe. I think I would give up stand-up if I could still do other shit. Could I still do anything else other than stand-up?
Well, you're the owner. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. You just said I couldn't do stand-up. If I'm the owner. I could.
You could host the shows. Maybe give yourself a spot here and there.
Well, then why wouldn't I? What you're saying is basically I can have everything I have now plus very nice yearly...
All right, it's a dumb question.
As questions go, it's one of the dumber ones I've heard. Our dear friend, well, he's not our dear friend, but he's a Comedy Cellar person, sort of. Colin Jost and Scarlett Johansson are engaged.
Unbelievable.
Any thoughts on that?
You know, I saw him at a restaurant once. I was having dinner at... what's it called? Peking Duck in Midtown.
Yeah.
And I was there with a group of people, and he came in for to have a pickup. for an order for, I guess, him and his fiance. And he came over to the table and said hello to me. And my friends were like, isn't that the guy from SNL? I'm like, yeah, it's him. I'm like, you wouldn't believe who he's going to marry.
Well, now everybody knows.
Yeah.
But it seems like a bit of a disparity in terms of level of showbiz success between him and unless Colin is bigger than I think he is. Hey, Noam is here.
Hey.
Hello, what? Noam. He's wearing a pea green sweater. I'm just trying to paint a picture. He was in traffic.
I'd say army green.
I don't know if it's army green or pea green. Noam, how's your mood?
It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. Not great.
What's the matter?
That's the subject you're talking about. You've been
we haven't been treading water. I think we've been swimming. I think at Olympic level.
So go ahead, just continue. Just continue.
Well, no, but now that you're, I mean, but as it happens, we were starting to run out of steam. But we were talking.
But you're only four minutes in.
No, we're 15 minutes in. But prior to that,
we were 15 minutes in.
Yeah, we were. We started right at the hour.
All right, well, it's not even okay. Whatever. I'm aggravated because I was 20 minutes standing still on 48th Street.
Maybe congestion pricing would be just the thing to alleviate the traffic.
Oh, I'm looking forward to congestion pricing. Me and all the rich people are going to breeze through Manhattan while the poor... I mean, it's horrible what they're going to do to the middle class.
That's fair.
I don't know if we want to get too into congestion pricing I just thought I'd mention it.
They're going to charge working people and everyday people and middle class people $12 or $11, whatever it is, for the privilege of being able to run their daily errands and get to work and drop their kids off in school and all that stuff. Or they're going to clear out the road so that more affluent people, and I don't claim to be rich, but people who, you know, whatever. We'll pay the people who will pay the $11.
I don't claim to be a nerd.
Well, let me put it this way. if I could pay $11 to express lane my way through traffic every day, I would. You know, I would pay it. So that's what they're setting up here. These New York mayors who claim to be so concerned about the middle class.
Well,
they do everything to fuck the middle class. They raise the parking fines. They tow people. They have congestion pricing. I mean, what do they even do for the middle class?
Anyway, well, the idea behind is that congestion pricing will raise money to improve public transport. That's the idea.
Oh, come on. Everything raises money and they'll spend it, and then at some point they'll need more. I mean, why can't they raise money from the entire city or state of New York to improve public transportation?
Well, they can, but congestion pricing has the additional benefit of easing traffic flow, which would help buses, which are a middle-class thing.
Oh, come on. Buses are not a middle-class thing. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, we were talking about...
Buses is an old lady thing and a Dan Natterman thing.
I
love taking the bus.
I'll let that stand.
Well, we were talking about, I don't know if you have anything to add to it, but the recent engagement of our friend Colin Jost with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, that's annoying too, isn't it? Well, the idea that we're 1 degree separated from marrying Scarlett Johansson. Who would have thought that?
Well, we were also 1 degree separated from dating Ariana Grande and Kate Beckinsale.
But marrying Scarlett Johansson... Yeah, I've been 1 degree separated from sleeping. I've slept with someone who was sleeping with a movie star. Like I've been that close, but marrying Scarlett Johansson, like that's incredible.
But I was asking, isn't that a bit the disparity between his fame and her fame? Unless I'm underestimating his fame, is fairly pronounced.
Yeah, he's a beta male. Who knew? No, I guess he doesn't care.
No, but whether he cares or not, it's unusual. I mean, how did this happen?
Lots of people marry people much less famous than they are.
Yeah, but usually it's the man that's more famous, typically. Yeah,
usually it's the man that's more famous. or they're semi-equal. But he's pretty famous, you know, and he's very, very talented. He was on our show one time. He's smart, he's good looking, he's funny, and he's on SNL. You know, SNL has a cool factor, which is on the scale along with fame, I believe.
I also did a show yesterday. I'm off, and I did a college show. And so I Googled where I was going, the college I was going. And now you can't Google anything without getting reviews of what you Google. You know what I mean? Like you could Google your friend Mark, and it's like, Mark, 3 stars. And you're like, who's reviewing Mark? Also, maybe I should stop hanging out with Mark. It's just this shitty three-star friend. I don't need that. So I went, I was going to this college, and I Googled it, and reviews came up, and the reviews were just terrible. And I'm not going to tell you what college it was, but it was Southern Connecticut State University. And the reviews were awful. And you Google a place, you'll Google a restaurant, a hotel, and reviews come up. And I honestly think if you're reviewing a place, like on Yelp or whatever, I think the worst review you can ever give something is 2 stars. If you give something 1 star, that's about you. That's about some weird, fucked up shit that's happening in your life, and no one will listen to you. Look at any 1-star review. It's like, I went to this Cafe Honduras. I had lunch there, and that's where I found out my cat had committed suicide. 1 star. I called up this so-called hotel. They told me a room there was $300 a night. Do you think I can afford $300 a night? Do you know how many times I've been divorced? Lobby looks pretty cool. 1 star. There was one, I swear to God, it was a review for a barber shop. It was like all caps. It said, I have never been to this barber shop and I'm never going. I was like, cool, keep us posted.
Truth is, I don't know how famous anyone is until they come to the Comedy Cellar and I hear the audience reaction. That's how I judge fame, because I'm around, I'm in our little world here, and I don't know what people that aren't in our little world, how who they don't know. So until I see them go on stage at the Comedy Cellar and see the reaction of the crowd, I really don't know. Like I like Mulaney. I didn't know he was that big a deal, but he goes on stage and the crowd,
I know now that he's really famous, but you're right. There was a period there where he was really famous and we didn't realize. But then his kid, what's the name of his special? Kid Marvelous?
Kid Gorgeous.
Sorry about that, John. Kid Gorgeous was on the air, and then I realized, oh, he's huge. And it's a great special. By the way, did we talk about this? Steve Fabrica did the Slate
podcast?
Yeah,
we talked all about it.
Did he mention that he told everybody, he told America that the Comedy Cellar is cramped and people complain about it all the time?
Oh, I don't remember that.
I knew you would find something.
I thought that was fine. But somebody did text me. It's like, why is Steve telling everybody the Comedy Cellar is cramped? Like,
who told you that?
Oh.
But your brother listened to it. He thought you were great.
I enjoyed it. I mean,
it was great.
Enjoy these Slate.
You sent it to.
Yeah, I sent it to. Why should I send it to? You were great.
I'm enjoying these.
You didn't even send it to me. I didn't even know it was out until.
Well, I figured you would know.
I'm enjoying these Slate Comedy Cellar podcasts, but I don't know if the public at large, because I always said to you, Noam, I think that what goes on in the Comedy Cellar is pretty interesting, but. Who's listening? Are there?
Why aren't we doing this on our show? Why are we giving Slate all of it?
Why aren't we doing what?
Well, I guess we have Steve now, but doing like a little series like that here. People are obviously.
You can. I've talked to you guys about this. I just don't want to be involved in it. I am so bored with anything like that. But.
We can do, and what we did today is we talked a bit to Steve about the Comedy Cellar.
Can you imagine me interviewing like Aaron, our manager, waiter? An hour asking about what it's like to do his job.
I don't think we should. I think what we should do is.
I can't believe they asked me.
And I said, well, so what's your favorite story about? What was it? Do you ever one of those nights where like something really funny happened? What's your dream lineup at the Cellar? Who's really an asshole but people don't know it?
Well, but I think what we can
do. Tell.
What we can do and what we've done today is we have Steve on. We ask him a couple questions.
Wait, Noam, did you listen to it?
I listened to it.
And
I'll tell you something else. I listened to Estes also.
Estes is good.
Yeah, except that Estes, they ask her, would you ever consider booking for another club? And she says, never say never.
Really?
Well, look, if you fired her, would she have no choice?
That wasn't the question. The question, would she consider?
Well, I interpreted that to mean as if for whatever reason she was no longer working at the Comedy Cellar. and she'd have no choice.
Always
at that
take
point.
Her side. Maybe you're right.
So
maybe.
Did you like what I said?
I thought you were great.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think it's. I think
you know that, I didn't want to do it.
I know. I think that when you tell the truth. And you describe the place as it is, warts and all, the good, the bad, that it comes through sincere, and it actually makes people want to go. I think when you're being cagey, like a politician, and we see this when people run for president, like they're really appealing until they're running for president, and they're always afraid to say the wrong thing, and nobody believes them anymore.
I try not to name too many names with stories, but...
He also said I was the smartest person he knew, so that I forgot that.
I retract. I take that back.
That was good. I like
that. But... says the most negative thing about how I said the place is a little basement that's uncomfortable to sit in. I'm not taking away from the allure of the Comedy Cellar being the greatest comedy club in the world.
But what's wrong with even saying that? I mean, I think that
it's part of the
phenomenon. Totally. I mean, I think that's part of what makes it interesting and sort of
no. But my autistic friend.
No. He's gonna. The fuck's the matter with you?
Well, why would he point out the one negative thing?
Then don't say his name.
We didn't say his last
you
name.
You already said his name.
But I didn't call him autistic. Like,
is he autistic?
No.
Well, just friends. Well? Just friends busting balls. That's what we do. You've called me autistic on more than one occasion.
Well, and it's nice that you thought that was just friends busting balls. But anyway, can you beep out the name?
Yes, okay. I can.
But you said it. You said it too, and.
Well, he's going to know what you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, people might all over America are going to Google
autism.
How many viewers do you have, listeners?
I don't know, but can you just 10? Take that out? Anyway, so let's talk about something else.
Well,
it'll kind of be funny to hear all the beeps.
By the way, so are you excited, Noam, that Adam Carolla is coming on the show?
Well, I'm annoyed with our producer.
Why, Perry L, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, not Lou. Excuse me. This was sent to you 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the link didn't work, and you called me half an hour ago going, the link doesn't work.
Yes, that's exactly right. I'm talent here. You're a production.
What am I?
You send me a link. You need to vet it and make sure it works.
Well, that may be true, but you should also look at your emails more than 15 minutes before
no,
you're about
the link
to walk
I
in.
I know myself. I'm not going to take notes. I mean, I could take notes on it. I'm going to listen to it on the way to the interview to be fresh in my mind, and I can ask questions. Is that That's not a valid...
Well, you also apparently didn't know that you needed to be here at 12 o'clock because you don't read the emails I send you.
Meet here at 12. No, I left before 11. It's crazy traffic today. But I did, and in the car, I saw where it start with Steve, but I wasn't sure who Steve was.
Right, except that I had sent 5 emails in the past 2 weeks preparing you for all of that, listen, including the link to the special.
I want to explain to you something. I just want to come and talk. Like, I just want to come here. Like, I know it's not that I don't care. It's that it's fine with me to show up and see who's there. Like, I know, like, next week we have Tyler Cowen or tomorrow.
It's actually tomorrow.
And Glenn Lowry. And these are important guests that I need to do my homework for. But, you know, and the Adam Carolla thing I intend to do my homework for.
Did you?
15 minutes before.
Well, actually, I did. I tried to listen to some other interviews. No, not 15 minutes before, an hour before, which would have been enough time.
I just think that, like, if I had sent that link and it didn't work yesterday, then you could be annoyed with me.
You know what's a great topic is how people deflect rather than take ownership for something.
Right. You should be taking ownership for not looking at what I sent in a timely fashion.
No. I feel that in my position here as the host of the show, whatever, and your position is to present me with like a folder, as it were, of materials, that if that folder of materials turns out to be defective, that's the end of the story. Like, you should, oh shit, I'm sorry. Like, I don't have to account to you when I wanted to listen to it. That wasn't my job that I dropped the ball. I did my job. I was gonna listen to it on the way to the interview.
Well, it's fair enough. I accept that. I should have tested the link.
Yes. Now, having said that, yeah, you didn't realize that these links can be wrong, so now you learned a lesson. But I went through this with our last producer. You know, we had this big fight about not confirming a guest. Oh my God, we were literally almost came to blows. We got in this fight so bad. I'm like, you need to confirm. The dentist confirms 48 hours before. Every other podcast I've ever done, like the New York Times podcast, I'd get an email 48 hours before. And we were confirming our guests after not speaking to them for 3 months. 6 hours before. And of course, the guest didn't show up. And instead of just saying, yeah, and you're right, next time I'll make sure. He said, no, I don't need to do that. That's the guest's fault. I'm like, no, it's not the guest's fault because we have no guest. Like, he didn't lose. We have to, defensive driving is a legit concept, right? No. People will not take ownership of their mistakes.
I take ownership that I should have tested that link.
Now, maybe the link was good when you got it, and it's no longer. Maybe it expired.
Well, no, I don't know if that's the case.
Noam,
or not.
Do you plan on exploring abortion with Adam?
I this is another topic that kills me, so to speak.
No pun intended.
I know it's a topic that yeah, I would love to talk to him. You think he'll talk about abortion?
I don't know. I mean, I think it would be interesting to get his perspective. I mean, we could talk about.
He's not going to bring it up.
He won't bring it up, but we could bring it up.
I feel like Every guest we have, we try to talk about abortion with him. With Pete Holmes,
The abortion topic is endlessly infuriating.
Well, I find it endlessly fascinating. Noam finds it endlessly infuriating.
Well, I'll tell you why I find it infuriating. You can tell me why it's fascinating. I find it
infuriating. Probably for the same reasons.
Because without regard to whether you believe it should be legal or believe it should be illegal or when you think there should be a cutoff, any of that, there is a profound philosophical issue that you can toss around and that anybody ought to recognize is complicated, that smart people like Christopher Hitchens, have had positions on it you wouldn't expect because it's such a difficult issue. And they will not engage on the merits. They will say...
You're speaking of...
Well, people usually... I usually argue with people who are pro-choice or talk to people who are pro-choice. They'll say that either something like, a man shouldn't be telling anybody about anything about abortion. I'm like, well, that's it? Like, that's how we avoid any discussion of whether or not there's a life, not a life, when it's okay to take a life, what the cutoff is, if it's okay in the ninth month. We avoid all of that simply by saying, you got to go find me a woman. So I got to haul in a woman. I have to haul in a woman. So I have like an ultrasound of my son. I've said this like at 5 months old. And he's sucking his thumb and he has the hiccups. And so I'm who wants to do the right thing, wonders to himself, how is this not alive? And there's got to be a better answer than you're a dude, so shut up. Like that's the answer, right? I want to understand why this is not killing a baby. You're a dude, so shut up.
This passes
for logic. This passes for reason. And that's not to say that there's not a good answer to why it's okay to kill it or to extinguish it or whatever you want to say it is. But that's not logic to say you're a dude, so shut up. And that's half the answers we get. Another answer is it's a woman's right to control her own body, which is a conclusion, not an answer. That is not a logic to why, because the answer will come back is, okay, well, what about the fetus's or the baby's right to his body? You can't even get into the question because they've developed these magical shields which are designed to avoid getting into the merits of the conversation at all. It's all a way to shut you down. You can't talk about it because you're a dude. You can't talk about it because it's a woman's right. Never mind that the polls show that there's no difference between men and women on their attitudes about abortion.
Can I speak?
No.
Okay.
Women don't speak.
We got Adam coming in. I think he's coming down the hall.
Let him speak.
I think Adam is coming in.
Go ahead, Perry. Do your thing. You have to say something. I don't want to cut you off.
I think that you...
I do, but I don't want people to think I cut you off.
Right. You focus on this one part of this issue.
Yeah. Good answer.
No, it's true. And I think that you can't do that without taking...
We got
it. Okay, we got Adam is. We got Adam Carolla. Adam Carolla, everybody.
Is he coming in here?
Welcome, Adam Carolla. And thank you for coming to our Live from the Table radio show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we normally, by the way, do this at the Comedy Cellar on McDougal Street. We made a special trip for you because of our adoration for all you do.
Well, if that's true, I am flattered.
Well, it is true that
it is true
that we came all this way.
Well, then I'm flattered.
And are you familiar, by the way, with the Comedy Cellar?
I've never played at the Comedy Cellar, but of course I'm familiar with it.
Well, I'm sitting next to me is Noam Dorman, the owner of the Comedy Cellar.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
And you might remember him or not, because during the whole Louis C.K. scandal, he was being interviewed all the time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I don't know if you caught wind of any of his interviews.
I feel like there's too much Schadenfreude with Louis and the world and scandals and all that stuff. It feels weird to me. Like I try to avoid all of that. Like I feel the same way. Like I see an accident by the side of the freeway and I'm driving. I don't like slowing down and looking. Like I feel like it's not my business.
I agree with you. I had no choice but be caught up in it. But I agree with that sentiment on most of the things going on in the world.
Yes,
a lot of
most.
Schadenfreude or meanness. It's just like a mean pleasure that people take in all these things, all this misfortune that other people have.
Well, I don't think, you know, my feeling is like look for things that elevate your life, your career, your interests, your whatever. Other people being lowered down into, you know, a pot of molten lead doesn't really help you. You may be standing outside of it and you may be thinking, well, I'm not getting my ass burnt, so this is a good day. But it still doesn't mean your job, your family, your lot in life is any better just because someone else is being brought down. You shouldn't. And also, I don't think you want to get a sense of you shouldn't have a sense of, well, I'm doing better because that guy's doing worse, because that doesn't get you or your career or your life anywhere. That just means the other person stepped back.
Well, there were a lot of stand-up comics who really were dancing on Louis' grave, as it were. I mean, there was, he had a lot of, I don't want to say enemies, but he wasn't beloved by some. And they clearly took, right? They clearly took some pleasure in him, in his plight. And that was disturbing within the stand-up community, I thought.
Yeah, probably. You know, I think that, I mean, to Adam's point about other people's failure doesn't mean that you're doing better makes sense on paper, but human nature being what it is.
Well, Dan feels better when...
Well, you know, they...
I'll be honest.
There's a saying in AA, you shouldn't compare into... I'm not an AA guy, but some of their sayings are interesting. But they say you shouldn't compare and despair.
Mm-hmm.
But you ever hear that?
Yeah, I'm not a religious guy, and I'm not sober either, but most of the stuff, like the Ten Commandments, makes sense. Like, most of the stuff that AA puts out there, and the Ten Commandments and everything else, I do like that. Like, I wish a lot of people engaged in the Ten Commandments, even if I don't believe Moses brought them down from the hill. But the part, it used to be frowned upon. The Schadenfreude was kind of frowned upon, and we had a little more dignity. And I think if you look back in the day, if somebody, let's just say, a woman dumped you, and then a year later you saw her at a party and she was with her new boyfriend. And in the day, decorum would dictate that you would say, I'm happy for her. She seems to have met the right fella, and I wish them a lot of luck. Even if in your heart you were dying or you weren't feeling that way, society would kind of dictate that you say that. But now it's like, that guy's a douche, and his hair's thinning, and I hope they both rot, and I hope they both get into a moped accident if they go on vacation. And it's kind of distilled down to that, and I don't like that. I like the part where people pretended a little bit. Like, even if you did have feelings about Louis and Louis's demise, those were your feelings. Well, you weren't supposed to wear them on your sleeve.
I think we can agree that the feelings are hard to avoid, but the expression of those feelings is more than
just the feelings. The feelings are very human. The expression of the feelings, that's the new twist.
Right, and we used to understand that just because that certain human instincts, I mean, this is what culture is, certain human instincts and certain human feelings are nothing that we should be proud of, and we should learn to control them. That's what culture is a way to teach us how to behave, right? But now we're validating everything. Anyway, I want to mention your new special. Adam Carolla has a new a new special out of, called Not Talkable Material. And it is available on chassis.com, C-H-A-S-S-Y.com. The film is now available on chassis.com and on demand.
Yes.
And I watched the trailer, and I was kind of stunned and admiring that you had right on the trailer a kind of politically incorrect gay joke about your son and hoping that he'll be a top and not a bottom.
Yes.
How do you have the courage to fend off these politically correct lions in this day and age?
I don't know. I don't care.
You don't care.
I don't care about them. I just, whatever's funny to me makes
but
the
is,
cut.
But is there any truth to that statement that if your son were gay, you'd, or that you, if your son were gay, would that be, make a difference? I mean, Noam, because Noam said quite clearly he'd prefer his son to be straight, and he says that with all, can I say that, Noam, or do we have to cut that out?
I prefer all things being equal?
Yeah.
Yeah, I said if you put a gun to my head, anybody who claims, oh, I just have no preference. You're not going to get a preference out of me, so you might as well shoot me. That person is probably a liar.
Well, some are liars, some are not.
Let me. You have a preference about blue eyes, brown eyes. You have a preference about everything, right?
The joke is I'm assuming he's going to be gay.
Right.
And that's fine. I'm just hope he's a top. That's basically the joke. I'm keeping my fingers crossed as a dad that he's a top. So I don't even really, as far as the joke goes, it's not really I don't know where the victim is in the joke, but I don't really care. I just, if it's funny to me,
it made me laugh out loud when I was listening to it. But I don't know if I was laughing at the joke and also the fact that you just don't hear these kind of jokes anymore.
Well,
as often anyway.
You know, my feeling with jokes is I tell jokes, you know, there's a gay joke or there's a black joke, you know, it's not in the special, but one of the jokes I'll say as it pertains to the black community is I'll say black folks play a game called dominoes. They know how to play dominoes. White people set up dominoes on their ends and then knock them over. That's our version of dominoes. And
you're making fun of black people?
Yeah, that's exactly. Like, I don't know. Am I making fun? They know how to play dominoes. We don't know how to play dominoes. We play them in a stupid way. And if I ever come across any black people that are just setting up chess pieces and knocking them over, I will teach them how to play chess. Now you go like, so some people hear that and they go, whoa, 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 hold on.
You're saying black
whoa.
People can't play chess?
Yeah, whoa, like, whoa. It's like, I don't know. It struck me. And I swear to God, if you do that joke in a club and there's a black guy in the club, he will know how to play dominoes and white people don't know how to play dominoes. It's an observation.
Yeah, my wife's Puerto Rican and they play dominoes. I mean,
it's an ethnic thing that Whitey doesn't, although we set him up. It's funny that we don't play him, but we slap him over. But either way, my feeling is we don't have to look that deeply into that joke. It's an observation. In my eyes, it's true. I don't think it's negative against black people or Puerto Rican or whoever knows how. In fact, it's kind of a positive in that they know how to play a game that we don't know how to play. And I'm not sure what the hubbub is. I don't know what we're supposed to infer from that joke.
Yeah, and how can you expect at a time when things like cultural appropriation, when the differences between cultures and colors is considered to be so stark and so important, and we're hearing this every day, of course we're going to joke about it. I mean, like, how do you not joke about the things that you see in front of your face every single day? What are we supposed to joke about?
I don't
it's
know.
Human nature.
I don't know. I don't know how any of it works, but my feeling is if it's funny, then I'm in.
So are you a conservative? Would you call yourself a conservative?
No.
You wouldn't?
No. Many of the thoughts I've had my whole life have been converted into a conservative,
mm-hmm.
sort of from a political standpoint, but no. I've always said, you know, do whatever you want, pay for your kids, don't have kids if you can't afford kids. If you do have kids, stay around and raise those kids. Those were things I've said into the radio for 25 years, and all of a sudden a lot of the stuff has been transformed into like conservative talk, but it was never it wasn't considered a conservative notion when I used to say it. I haven't changed my tune.
Right, but the definition of if you rail against I heard you somewhere kind of telling a story about white privilege and kind of poking holes in the idea of white privilege.
Yeah.
That's a conservative point of view in 2019.
Yeah, but my story, which I've always told, which is I grew up poor. I went to go try to get a job as a LA firefighter when I was 19 because I didn't have a job and I didn't have any prospects and didn't go to college. My family didn't have any money. And my mom was on welfare and food stamps and the whole nine yards. And I went in to go apply to be a fireman because I thought this is a good job. I didn't have an education, but I had a strong back and I was fairly fearless that I didn't have a high regard for my own safety. So I signed up to go be a fireman and they said, yeah, okay, but we'll contact you in about 7 years. And I remember going, well, why the wait? And they said, you're white. We're not hiring any white guys.
They actually said that.
Yeah. Well, he said it was a guy. Yeah. He just said, look, we're not hiring. I'm gonna be honest with you. You fill out the application, but don't expect to hear from us. I did hear from them 6 or 7 years later to be a fireman. Literally, it was so long after that the paperwork was sent to my dad's house where I didn't live anymore. I was a carpenter at that point. But my dad, 7 years later, said, I got something from the LA Fire Department about a test day. I actually took the test just because I'd been waiting for 7 years. But in terms of white privilege, I didn't grow up with any white privilege. I grew up poor and I couldn't be a fireman and so on and so forth. Now people can argue and go, yeah, well, but what about what you don't know? I mean, who knows what you don't know? I don't know. Look, I'm 6'2". There's an advantage to being taller. I have all my hair. There's advantages to that. There's advantages to many different and disadvantages to many different physicalities. But I don't like the notion of just saying you're privileged because this is the color of your skin. When I grew up with tons of poor people, they struggled. They struggled with addiction. My best friend's dad was in jail. There was a ton of that. And it exists in all communities. I don't feel like that's a useful conversation to have.
Well, and it's not to say that people are not born privileged, and it's not to say that many of those people born privileged are white.
Right.
But you just can't dismiss any accomplishment by a white person by saying it's white privilege. Next question.
Yes.
I mean, there are countries where people are all white. Then you
yeah,
have to, then
I don't know. It's a dumb question to have in 2019. And my white privilege is this. I have had, I believe there are way more assholes than there are racists. I have had almost every house I've lived in, I've had a horrible neighbor. And they've done things that are just horrible. Like they called Department of Building and Safety and check unsanitary living conditions. The next thing you know, I have notices coming to my house for hearings on stuff because the hedge is too high. Like I've had crazy old white people next to me my entire life in many different houses. I was doing some construction at my house. I got the phone line crossed somehow. I picked up the phone and I was like, hello, Terry Lumber. And they were like, hello, some woman, this is Gladys. Oh, hello. And I was like, oh, the phone lines are screwed up. Hung up the phone. The cops showed up at the house. She called the cops. And what I tell people all the time is if I were black, I would assume these people are racist because they're horrible. My white privilege is knowing that they're assholes, not racist. Possibly both,
right? Right.
No, I agree. We've talked about similar incidents. I had an incident with the cops one time where next thing I knew, I found myself up against the wall being treated roughly. And I remember thinking at the moment, if I were black, there'd be nothing you could fucking tell me to convince me this was not happening because I was black.
Yes.
Nevertheless, it was happening to me. So you can make, you can draw conclusions in the aggregate, but in any specific instance, you usually don't really know, and you can get it wrong. I want to apologize again for not getting that the name of the plug right exactly, and I feel stupid about that. All right, next question.
By the way, Adam's special is multimedia. You have a monitor.
Yes.
And you have pictures, and then you comment. I don't know if anybody else is doing that in the stand-up. Arena, but you'll show a picture of your family, and then you'll comment on the various what's in the picture.
I wanted to display my Social Security statement, and so you can take a look firsthand at my white privilege. And it's part of the story in the stand-up special, which is sort of autobiographical, is all the money I've earned when you get your Social Security statement from like 1980. To now. So I put up there what I made every year from the time I was in the 10th grade to a few years ago, essentially, you know, well after I was in show business. And, you know, I think a lot of people talk about where they come from, or, oh man, I was poor, or people sort of downgrade now. They go, we weren't upper middle class. We were middle class. But then at some point, they let little things slide. Like they'll go, and so when I was in Aspen skiing my junior year, and they're like, what were you doing? Where's Aspen? How'd you get to Aspen? Oh, we weren't rich. We're middle class. So when we're in Maui the following year on a vacation, and I'll go, how'd you get to Maui? Who goes to Maui? No one goes to Maui. I never met a person that went to Maui. Like, so I wanted to let people know like just how downtrodden my life was for as many years as it was. So I just put it up there in black and white. But also, when I'm making fun of my family and the crappy house or my crappy parents, like, I want you to see who I'm making fun of.
Yeah, I looked at your house. I didn't think it was all that bad. My house growing up was pretty crappy too, but we weren't poor. My father was just cheap.
Yeah, I wish my dad was cheap.
But nobody wants to be everybody wants to come from nothing. I don't know if in England in England the whole notion was you wanted to be born into the right family. I don't know if it's still that way, but in America we all want to be. Ideally, I wish I came from the projects and I could, but I can't say that.
I think growing up with a cheap dad is much worse than growing up with a poor dad. I think psychologically, if your dad says to you, "I'm sorry, we just can't," you understand that. But if your dad says to you, "I won't," That rings differently. I could get that for you. I'm just not going.
Well, he never said that. I don't know.
Well, he was cheap.
I'm guessing he was cheap because we did do some nice things now and then. But so I think he had the money. But at the same time, I shared a bicycle with my sister, and I had a bicycle that was made of used parts from a junkyard.
Did he?
But I went on a bike trip in Cape Cod. So on the one hand. You know, he had the money to send me to on this teen bike trip. On the other hand, I had a bike made from spare parts that he bought from my friend Greg's father. So,
did you go to college? Did he pay for college?
Yeah, he paid for college. Oh, it was a waste of money.
That's something.
But he did pay. I mean, for what I'm doing now, which is stand-up comedy, I didn't need. I mean, high school was too much. But
sure, right.
Can I ask you this? Maybe I should know this. How did you parlay your construction career into a world famous comedy career?
I was interested in radio, and I used to listen to radio when I was working on construction sites, morning radio, because you start at 7 a.m., right. And you're just there, and the guy's got the boom box and crank it up, whatever. So I would listen to a lot of morning, as a matter of fact, in construction, you sort of hear the whole morning four-hour chunk, because I'd get in my truck at 6:15 in the morning, turn on the local rock station, listen to the morning guys, and by the time I got to the job site and then they'd turn it on the boom box, it would just go, and you'd work till 3 or 4 in the afternoon, so you'd hear the whole thing. I was working as a boxing coach in the mornings, and I was doing carpentry in the afternoons was my schedule. I always had a love of boxing, and at some point I was able to translate or parlay working as a carpenter into working my way in as a boxing coach at one of those places called Bodies in Motion. And it was like executive boxing, like I teach lawyers and school teachers, how to box. So I taught boxing, and I had a couple of private students and stuff like that. And I was delivering a entertainment unit that I'd built for Marjorie Gross, who was a comedian writer. She worked for, she, I think she was Canadian. I think she worked for Seinfeld as a writer at the time. And I was going over Laurel Canyon in LA, and I heard Kevin and Bean at KROQ, the morning show. I heard Jimmy the sports guy, who was the sports guy who was on the station, the sidekick on the morning show. He'd only been there about 2 months, and he was doing the sports. And one of these sort of morning zoo things broke out where he was going to have a boxing match with the Michael, the maintenance man. So it was like morning zoo. This guy's going to box that guy. And I was just driving, and I was like, oh, I want to know what's going on inside the studio and meet Kevin and Bean and all this kind of stuff. And I'm a boxing coach. And they were saying, we need coaches, we need trainers, we need a venue, and we need equipment. We're going to do this boxing match. It was kind of unfolding in real time. And so I just kept calling into the station like, hey, I'm a boxing coach. I could teach Jimmy or Michael, the maintenance man, to box. And no one ever called me back, and it never worked. And eventually I went to the station and I got into the building, but I couldn't get up the elevator. Like, it would be like this building. Like, you could go into the lobby, but the station was closed on the ninth floor in Burbank, California. So the next day I found out what time the elevator worked. It was like 7. I had a guy cover my boxing class. I went up to the ninth floor. I went to K-Rock. But K-Rock was closed. K-Rock didn't open till 9. And I was just standing in the hallway by the elevator at like 7:15 in the morning, and they would never return my calls. And a guy went in, got out of the elevator, and was going into the back entrance with the key card or whatever to K-Rock. And I said, if you're going in there, can you tell Kevin and Bean or anybody who's in there that there's a boxing coach and he's just waiting by the elevator, and I want to teach either one of those guys to box. I'll just wait. And I just waited out there for half an hour. And at some point through the back entrance down this long hall, Jimmy Kimmel just came walking down the hall. And he said, you're a boxing coach? And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, okay, when do you want to start? And I said, today. And he said, okay, I'll see you, I think, at noon in Pasadena where I taught. And I just waited for him in the parking lot, and I trained him for this boxing match. But I was really trying to sell him on my comedy the whole time, but I didn't want to come across like a weirdo who wasn't a boxing coach. Right. So I trained him how to box. We had like 3 weeks. After the 3 weeks, he thought I was really funny, and he lost the fight, and he didn't have much juice around the station. He was kind of he was the sports guy, and he only been there for like 2 months. So he was kind of like, I can't just go tell Kevin and Bean, you're going to be on the radio. They're not going to go for that. But he said, come up with a character, call in, you know, the fight was like on Friday, call in Monday. And they're probably not going to like it, he said. And it'll be one and done, because if they don't like it, they're just going to move on. And I won't tell them who it is, because I don't want to tell them it's the boxing coach, because they're going to go, it's a boxing coach, you're going to do comedy on our show. I won't tell them who you are. I'll just tell them you're a guy's calling in. I got a bit. Trust me, he'll call in. And I just called in, and it worked. Like, the bit worked. And I talked to Jimmy, and I was like, wow, what'd they think? It's like, they thought it was fine. They said, do it again next week. And I was like, okay. And he just did it next week. And I did it the next week. And then it became popular. And meanwhile, Jimmy and I were like, you know, going out to lunch every day, talking about comedy, and we want to do our own show. And, you know, and we were just the lowest. I wasn't getting paid. He was barely getting paid. And we'd go every day at lunch and like scheme about making our own stuff. And how could we work together? Like, they're not going to let us work together at the radio show station, but we could do a show and we could work together. Somehow we'd spend all day in the same office. It was like a dream. for us, and that's kind of how it began.
That's an amazing.
That is an amazing story. I mean, as showbiz success stories go, that's pretty incredible. You kind of bulldozed your way in.
Well, and not to be corny, but there's lessons there for everybody in terms of perseverance, in terms of making your own luck, and also all the little things that do fall in place in a life sometimes that you can't imagine.
You know, when I said to the guy, Bruce Gordon, who owned Bodies in Motion a year earlier, I said, I want to teach boxing at your boxing gym. And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, you had an amateur career, but we hire professionals, like people whose names you've heard of, to teach boxing, not no names with amateur backgrounds. And I said, okay, but I'm looking at your club and I'm seeing like there's heavy bag laying on the floor and a speed bag that's like down on the ground. I said, I can mount all that stuff. I'm a carpenter. I can fix your gym up and I'll do it. I'll do it for $10 an hour. I'll give you a real cheap rate and I'll do it in the middle of the night after the place is closed. It closes at 11 at night. I'll come in at 11. I'll work till 6 a.m. till you open and I'll do it all on the cheap. And all I ask is that you give me a chance to teach a boxing class. You don't have to pay me. And if I'm not a good coach, then you don't have to hire me, but just give me a chance. And he said, okay, yeah, go hang the bags, knock yourself out. And I did that for a few months. And then he said, I'm gonna open a gym in Pasadena. You build out the gym in Pasadena and you can teach the morning class there. And I said, okay.
Yeah, so I can see exactly why the idea of privilege would get your goat. I
mean, well, when you look on all that you've accomplished coming from basically zero and to where you are now, I mean, it must be very satisfying. You must have a great deal of pride, or you don't think about it.
I don't think about it that much. I'm honestly happy to do shows like this where people bring it up because it gets me to sort of think about it, because I'm very day-to-day and what's broken, I gotta fix it. You know, I'm not in sort of sit back and relish mode. I'm like, what's wrong? What do I need to do? What do we need to fix? How do we make this work? So it's nice taking a little walk down memory lane, but it's interesting. One of my passions is cars, and I have a lot of race cars, and I race old vintage race cars, and I race a lot of Paul Newman race cars. And so I have a collection of Paul Newman race cars. And every once in a while, people will say like, oh, my dad's a big fan of Newman, or he's a big fan of vintage racing, or he remembers these cars from back in the day or something. Could I bring him over on a Saturday and let him just walk through your shop? And I go, yeah, okay. Like, I'm open to it. And at some point, after giving him a tour of the shop, the people inevitably go, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, this was great, you made his day, blah, blah, blah. And I always go, no, thank you. And they go, why are you thanking me? I go, because I don't get it, I don't really appreciate it. I run through it. Like, I live and work in my shop, but I don't stop and really appreciate it. And what you're doing by bringing your dad here, or mentioning what we're mentioning now, is you're stopping and making me appreciate it. Because I'm telling the story of the car, and the dad is going, oh man, that's awesome. And then they go, do you drive these cars? And I go, yeah, I drive them. And they go, oh, that's so cool. And I go, oh yeah, I guess it is cool. And then I start to appreciate it. So like, sometimes, whether it's a little walk through memory lane or a little appreciation of some of the things you have, it's kind of nice to bring that person in and explore it a little bit, and it renews your feeling with it.
To make you, what I think ought to make you feel very good, you also went all in on podcasting, I believe, like from my way I perceived it, before anybody knew podcasting could become what it became. And you had the confidence in yourself in some way to do that. So you kind of had more than one chapter where you started from zero and kind of conquered the world. So that's, yeah, I think you should feel very good.
Okay.
I think you should.
I will, until I have to go to Starbucks and three people are in front of me in line and I'm like, God damn, I'm cursed. I tell you, I'm cursed. Oh, she's getting a latte. Jesus Christ. And a sous vide, we're done.
All right, Adam Carolla has a new comedy special, Not Taco Bell Material. It is out now on chassy.com, chassy.com. And on demand.
Yeah, iTunes or Amazon.
And iTunes and Amazon. And that's it. We're out of time. Oh, that's too bad. All right. We wanted to ask you about abortion, but
I'm all for it and against it.
That's kind of how I feel.
Yeah, I don't like it, but if anyone wants to do it, they should do it.
If you're going to indulge us, how do you feel about the fact that people say you're a man, you can't talk about it?
I don't like that for anything. But I don't feel that way about any cultural stuff. Like, I'm allowed to have ideas about the black community. I don't have to be black. I'm observant. You know, why should that be limited? And you should be in the black community, and women should have thoughts about me as well. I don't like that thought.
I got in a big fight with a comedian the other night. Was kind of screaming, and I said, "You mean to tell me that if I had an essay, a logical essay discussing abortion, like very learned, logical essay, that you would have to know whether it was a man or woman who wrote it before you could judge it? Like, that's just absurd to me."
Well, not only is it absurd, but it is what you're supposedly fighting against. We're not supposed to be looking at gender, color, whatever. We're supposed to be hearing ideas.
Yes, well, that's kind of become a conservative point of view now also, unfortunately. Didn't used to be when I was a kid, it wasn't.
Right, that's my point.
Yeah.
By the way, Adam, if you ever come to the Comedy Cellar, I think it's fair to say, food on the house.
Half price.
All right. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'd be honored to have you come down just to shoot the shit, not, you know, no pressure to perform.
I'd love to perform.
Oh, that'd be even better.
Yeah. Let's make a day. I mean, I'm leaving and 2 hours and 20 minutes, but the next time I come to New York,
you could literally walk in
it
just anytime you want off the street.
Well, I would love, I'd be honored.
And we'll tell Dan he has to.
Can we get the multimedia? Can we get the multimedia set up for him?
No, this will just be straight.
We could do that if you wanted it. We could do
that. No, I'm not doing that. I mean, I'm just doing straight comedy now.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much. It's been an honor.
Thank you.
Adam Carolla, ladies and gentlemen.
Bye-bye.
Hey.